Hey everyone, welcome to our Year Me Goes Paper of the Month podcast. We are excited to have Tanya Dorf with us, friend of the show, friend of the meeting. And Tanya, welcome. We're going to talk about your recent paper of this PSMA-based bispecific T-cell engager that was just published. So maybe you can start, introduce yourself briefly, and then maybe start with, you know, mechanism of the drug. We've done actually a few podcasts on prostate cancer immunotherapy lately. So give us an idea of where this fits in mechanistically, and then we'll talk about the study.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm Tanya Dorf. I'm the Section Chief for Genitourinary Cancer at City of Hope in California. And I was really excited to be part of this huge, huge international effort on AMG-160, or what's now known as epacadamab, which is a CD3 and PSMA bispecific T-cell engaging antibody that was studied in advanced prostate cancer.
And so this is obviously, then you say bispecific. So the idea obviously to bring T-cells close to PSMA expressing cells.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, people talk about how the prostate cancer tumor microenvironment is cold and there are not maybe many T-cells going in by themselves. But so one wonders how much a drug like this can really overcome that just by trying to stick together a T-cell with a prostate cancer cell. And yet there's clear evidence that this does work. So there must be T-cells already in many people, maybe not all, maybe that's some of why it works for some and not others, right? But there must be T-cells going in, and there's just a lot of Tregs, MDSCs, you know, other suppressive components that just don't allow the T-cells to do their work. So to me, it's still a little bit surprising that something this simple, and yet maybe not so simple, can actually overcome that, because certainly some impressive responses were seen.
Tanya, is the point that PSMA is widely expressed? We saw that in And we've looked at that as a biomarker in the VISION trial, and it's highly expressed in prostate cancer. And by bringing T cells into the tumor microenvironment successfully, that is a catalyst to start the process of immune activation. Because some of your biomarker work showed interferon gamma signatures and all sorts going up. So is this the catalyst to start that? Because we know prostate cancer is described as an immune desert. It doesn't have many active immune CD8 cells. And is this the trigger to start that process? And is this the right target? Or are other targets like STEAP1 and HPN328, two previous bispecifics, are they better targets?
So PSMA is definitely widely expressed in prostate cancer, but we know that it's not 100%. So this study did not screen specifically for PSMA expression. And of course, it'll be interesting for those patients who did get PSMA PET scans as part of the study. They weren't mandated. But those who did, to try to correlate whether amount of expression is important. We think the amount of antigen you need to induce an immune response could be different than what you need for radioligand therapy targeting PSMA, for instance, because conceivably, once the immune system is engaged, there can be antigen spread. But I do think, you know, there will be important work to look at tissue expression, heterogeneity. You know, certainly in our CAR T-cell experience, we saw patients who are already in the process of evolving to a less androgen-driven prostate cancer having sort of heterogeneous responses.
So, Tanya, why don't you describe, this is a big sort of dose escalation and expansion study. Why don't you describe the study briefly and results, and then we can sort of dive in from there.
So this was a phase one study, but quite a large one, with a number of doses that were explored. So we started out really, really low with target doses, really in the 0.01, 0.03, kind of very low range, and slowly, slowly escalated. Cytokine release syndrome was seen as soon as we got to sort of reasonable doses and necessitated really a lot of cohorts. You know, typically you think of a 3+3 dose escalation as going pretty quickly and pretty straightforward, but we had a lot of safety calls with all the investigators contributing to think about how to make that cytokine release a little bit less severe, so that we could get to a big dose, but we certainly couldn't do it directly if we had just tried to give, you know, 0.9 milligrams all at once. You know, the cytokine release would have likely been very, very toxic. So step dosing was implemented. But where
you
patients
saw, so you
would...
saw cytokine release in most patients, some grade, and I think it was grade 3 in about a quarter of patients, 20-25%, is that right?
Yeah, maybe a little less than that, getting to grade 3, less than 20%, but it was less. Really...
What does grade 3 cytokine release look like?
Yeah, so it wasn't always dramatic. You know, even the... We saw this tremendous... transaminitis that would occur in some patients that for the hospitalist team could be really alarming, where the AST ALT just went off the rails and would almost immediately drop back down. But that could get you to a grade 3, right? So grade 3 cytokine release was not by any means patients going to ICU. So I must have treated 20 or 25 patients on the study, and only one went to ICU needing pressor support. And it was really low level pressor support. And, you know, he was feeling fine. He didn't seem, you know, in danger.
But that, I guess, maybe to back up a question for the field is, you know, this is, it looked like a typical CRPC population, you know, like other studies. Do you think the prostate cancer, let's just say community at large, people who give the drugs and people who receive the drugs, will accept that degree of toxicity, of cytokine release toxicity?
I think that's one of the important contributions of this experience and this paper, is trying to work that out. You know, how much cytokine release symptomatology is acceptable? How much can be managed outpatient? Because ideally, you know, we don't want to have to put patients in the hospital for the first few doses of a drug like this, which is what we were doing for most of the study. So it turns out that a little bit of fever and chills at home with proper support and access to 24/7 kind of expert nursing support at a minimum, and easy access into the cancer center, you know, even better, is a situation where patients could manage the cytokine release at home when it was mild enough. But this agent had really too much cytokine release, too strong. And then also the issue with the anti-drug antibodies limiting durability of effect of the drug against the cancer. So there were several issues, but if we're going to take something to phase 3 and take it to day-to-day practice in the community where most of oncology is practiced, it will have to be a cytokine release syndrome that's a little bit less common, a little bit less severe.
So it looked like the incidence and severity went down from exploration to expansion. Is that just a dose issue? Or
so
is it
was
an experience issue, or both, maybe?
Both, and really implementation of some key preventative measures. So using steroid premedication, giving boluses of IV fluid around the dose to kind of stave off the hypotension effect, education, doing these step doses. There was a cohort where we gave the first infusion as a 24-hour infusion. So many, many different things. But at the end of the day, I think it's just going to be a different compound that has a little bit different side effect profile that will be more likely to make it into practice.
How does how do you know you've got the right dose? Did you, should we, and we, you've gone to the point where you've got a dose which essentially you're not going to be able to probably give to thousands of prostate cancer patients easily in a randomized trial. What did your PK and PD data show at these sorts of doses?
So there was a target therapeutic range, and we found that it was important to get there during the first few doses of the medicine, and yet we had to use step dosing, these little baby doses, get some of the cytokine release out before we got to those target doses that got into a therapeutic range. So that was challenging. We know a range of right doses and a range of different steps that can get there. We certainly know what was too high. So in the highest dose cohorts, there was excess toxicity, which was interesting. You know, how much of it was target because there was some neuro stuff, some eye and hearing toxicity that we wouldn't have expected due to PSMA expression not being known to be present in those tissues. So is it just an acute activation of the immune system causing that? Is it related to the target? I think we'll learn that by studying other bispecifics that or immunotherapies that target other antigens. But so I can definitely say there was a too high dose. There are two low doses that maybe induce stability, but not response. And then a big issue with maintaining effective therapeutic dosing is the anti-drug antibodies.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that. How big of an issue? It seems like a huge issue. Is that you saw less cytokine release over time? Is it because just patients adapt, or is it in part related to these anti-drug antibodies? And how do you reconcile that ADA development with like maintaining clinical effect?
So I don't think the anti-drug antibodies were what dampened the cytokine release, because I feel like some of my patients who had anti-drug antibodies could still have some cytokine release. There's, you know, still some immune activation, and yet it's just not able to engage with the target as well. So the cytokine release goes away. We see this in other bispecific experiences as well. It somehow the body just gets used to it. I don't know. It's very different than like high dose IL-2 that we used to use for kidney cancer, where you kept pushing mm-hmm. the dose and you kept getting that, you know, different inflammatory cytokine syndrome. This, you really get it out of the way, and then you can keep giving the drug, and it can have activity without provoking that inflammatory response.
Why are we getting ADA so quickly? And are they your POU in the paper you talk about relatively short PFS? Is it driven by the ADAs, or is it just one of was there a correlation between ADA accumulation and reduced clinical outcome?
So not all of the ADAs, interestingly, were neutralizing. There were different kinds of ADAs. And certainly the neutralizing look like they impact response, but a full analysis hasn't really been completed on these. Sometimes they were transient. A patient would have ADAs one cycle and then they would disappear. From what I remember from the investigator calls, and I hope this isn't like proprietary, but you know, we published something about it in the paper.
You did. I did read about that. The other question, I guess, Tanya, would be, and we haven't covered this yet, we probably should. We haven't really talked. Were there other adverse events, or is it just this cytokine release syndrome that's a problem? And you did show some efficacy in a heavily pre-treated population. Do you want to just talk about those two issues?
Yeah, well, so I definitely want to talk about the responses, because I think in some ways you can't really tell just from the waterfall plots and the swimmers plots. I mean, there were definitely patients who were very, very sick going into this, and this drug helped them. So when you saw a response, it was actually quite clinically meaningful in many cases. You know, Amgen set the bar kind of high. They really thought a PFS less than 6 months wasn't something that would be exciting enough to take a drug that's, you know, a little bit more complicated to manage and deal with forward. So they really wanted to see enough swimmer plot patients getting past the 6 month bar and didn't. And I do think the anti-drug antibodies were a problem. There also was dropout due to toxicity for some patients, but especially at the higher levels. And that's where we saw some of those more neuro side effects. But you don't get a lot of chemotype toxicity. You're not getting nausea, vomiting. You're not getting everyday kind of toxicities. It's really, really primarily a profile of cytokine release.
And Tanya, do you think, you know, when a lot of immunotherapy up until recently was a small handful of patients had this dramatic durable effect, but most people don't, and that's why your medians don't look good. Is this different than that? I mean, you definitely had a subset of patients who had more dramatic and more durable effects, but is it enough? You know what I mean? Is it enough to move the needle for the whole cohort?
So there is definitely more than just the exceptional responder signal that we're seeing from the CAR T experiences, I would say. There's definitely a broader population that we see anti-tumor effect. And it's really just going to be about an agent that has a little bit different side effect profile, not as many anti-drug antibodies that will get us there. So I really am optimistic that this can be something where we're not looking for 10 or 20% to have a durable complete remission, which obviously would be great. And that's something that's maybe what CAR T can hope to do. But I think this could be a 50 or 60% of patients responding for a reasonable progression-free survival once we get it right.
Is this the right population and the right to test in? Is it too late in the disease? Are these patients going to struggle with particularly CRS, or actually could it be even worse earlier in the disease?
Yeah, it's a challenge, right? We really want to go earlier in the disease where antigen expression perhaps would be more homogeneous and patients would be more robust. But the side effect profile is such that, you know, bringing it early is a little bit challenging. So we have to, I think, develop it in a more advanced population that's more heavily pretreated, and maybe take a lower signal of efficacy and tolerability with that in mind, and then be able to move it into an earlier population.
And in terms of selecting patients, you presented some data on like PSMA PET results, which you said wasn't mandated or a selection, but it looks like a good chunk of patients had baseline PSMA PET, and that at least the PSA 50 response was higher in patients who were positive. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think a full exploration hasn't been done, but yes, there was a greater percentage of patients who met vision criteria sort of for PSMA positivity who responded. There's going to be, you know, tissue work. Obviously, tissue was submitted and likely some other correlatives, some other ways of looking at PSMA expression that might be important as well.
And you,
Tanya, when you...
Just one follow-up question. You probably don't have these data yet, but like you don't have documented examples of PSMA PET negative patients responding or negative lesions responding?
I haven't seen that, and okay. I'd be surprised.
Yeah, just curious.
Tanya, when you look at the response rate, they're probably not as good as we see for lutetium, which has a similar target and probably is better tolerated. Is that fair? Is this a drug which is going to have a lot of cross resistance with that agent, and in the end just turns out to be more toxic?
You know, I think we will be surprised that targeting the same antigen with different strategies may be not fully cross-resistant. And understanding that, I think, will be fascinating and will really advance the field. But there are definitely patients we're treating on some of our antigen targeting immunotherapy protocols that have had other forms of targeting of that antigen, whether it be radioligand or antibody drug conjugate with a more chemotherapy payload, who can still respond to an immunotherapy. So I guess, you know, it makes sense if you think about mechanisms of resistance to lutetium PSMA. You still see PSMA expression on the PET scan, even in patients who are not responding anymore, who are progressing, right? So it's if the antigen always went away and that was how resistance developed to all of these PSMA-targeted therapeutics, then we would really only have to be able to pick one. But I right. think we'll be able to sequence them. And again, it's going to be fascinating to try to understand what's optimal.
And you did some beautiful. You did see some responses in patients, PSA responses in patients who had prior lutetium. I mean, it's, you know, a collection, a small number, but at least proof of principle to what you just said.
Yes, absolutely. And anecdotally, I think even going from this to CAR T, it may be possible to see responses. So it is a good antigen target. It's not perfect, but it's probably, you know, the best we have right now, especially since there's an FDA approved therapeutic for it.
Yeah,
you did some beautiful work looking at CD8 and CD4 cells, dynamic changes to the immune repertoire. Do you want to just describe what you showed and why it was relevant?
Well, to be fair, this is Amgen doing this work. And again, I can't say enough about what great partners they were in developing this scientifically, with engagement from all the investigators around the world, and really keeping patients at heart. But that being said, we do see that the induction of effector T cells is associated with PSA decline. So, you know, obviously more work to be done. Why did some people have induction of effector T cells and others did not? But when you did, then you had the nice signal of interferon gamma secretion, well as other supportive cytokines.
Is there any evidence the underlying biology of the tumor in terms of its existing T cell immunity is associated with the response? Just by bringing some T cells in with PSMA targeting, it's not going to be enough in its own right. You're going to have something else there. And you did induce interferon gamma signatures, which I think is cool. But I mean, do you think in those patients that didn't respond, if you'd added a PD-1 inhibitor or you'd added another drug in, would you have augmented that response? Is there a combination strategy in the future to try and improve these results?
Absolutely. I think whether it's a checkpoint inhibitor like CTLA-4, which has been shown to sort of heat up the tumor microenvironment in a way that could be helpful, so that once these T cells are there and brought in by the bispecific, that there could be more anti-tumor effect, or rescuing. You know, we haven't yet studied whether exhaustion of T cells contributed. And in the setting of CAR T, there's been some work where a anti-PD-1 could rescue a partial response and convert it to a complete response in the solid tumor setting. So there's still a lot more to understand, but to your point of, is there something about the innate immune microenvironment that led to the responses? I think that very well could be possible, but learning who those patients are, and more importantly, then how can we create strategies that will make other people's tumors more hospitable, more inflamed, more ready for this kind of treatment will be how we can increase the effectiveness.
And I mean, on that front, Tanya, you kind of allude to this in the discussion, you know, whatever you can say that's public knowledge about the future of this particular molecule. Is it sort of a next generation molecule with less ADA or more of this or less of that? Or is it, you talk about combining with PD-1. I mean, what is the known strategy, if you can say it, or what do you think, if you controlled everything, what do you think the strategy should be?
So it's interesting. I think of bispecific T cell engagers as fairly simple compared to something like a CAR T, where you can put a bunch of different functionalities into it, right? But there are important aspects of the design of the molecule that can impact the toxicity profile. So I think a different molecule is needed, unfortunately. I mean, AMG-160 is great, but I think
it's not easy to remember, is it?
You know, the name?
Yeah, it's not the easiest name.
Yeah. I think there's something about the linkers. There's something about maybe the 2-to-1 tumor antigen to CD3 ratio that seems like potentially could be important for the toxicity and efficacy profile. And of course, we'll learn more about whether there are better antigens to target, like STEAP1. So, you know, you saw the very exciting data at ESMO of the AMG-509 showing some promise. So I think other molecules are learning a lot
experience. Do you think 509, do you think STEAP1 is a better target? Did you think that data was better data? And do you think we should be pursuing that one aggressively, or do you think both actually have got so many problems in terms of the practicalities of delivery that in the end we just need to move on and do something else?
No, I'm a little bit more optimistic about the potential decisions, perhaps.
Yeah.
I mean, STEAP1 looks good. There are issues. There are different side effects being seen with that molecule. But there are some different PSMA bispecifics that are hopefully going to move forward. And I think the question will be cost, right? And patient, not just financial cost, but patient time cost and patient side effect costs that will really have to be in a range that is acceptable. for a long enough duration of response to make it a good package, right? So clearly with AMG-160, we didn't get there, but will we get there with bispecifics? Will it take some other form of immunotherapy? I think jury's still out.
So that was going to be my final question is, do you think if we're sitting here in 3 years, 5 years, whatever the time frame is, that there will be a prostate-directed bispecific that's FDA approved?
I mean, I don't know about that specific timeline, but I think these drugs could make it to the finish line, and it just really takes creativity and doing a lot of work in the dose exploration, including some combination work, and doing the deep science so that whatever strategy is put into phase three, it'll be positive, right? So much goes into a phase three. I'd really hate to see something move to phase three without enough support behind it, mechanistically, scientifically, sure, all the combination studies that will make sure that it's a winner.
I'll tell you what I think here. I think these drugs are really exciting and they're novel. And I think this trial and the STEAP1 trial, and also, you know, we had the HPN328, so the NOTCH3 ligand study in neuroendocrine prostate cancer. I think these groups of bispecific T-cell engagers are really exciting. My concern is that I suspect you do need to use it in combination, and we don't know what the second drug is yet. And the second issue is I'm not sure going this late in the disease is the right place to launch a randomized phase three. And my concern would be that, you know, if there was a randomized phase three launched in the next 24 months, it probably would mean we haven't done enough homework to get this right. And so I think that five-year timescale is too short. I would rather spend the next 2 or 3 years learning more about which drug is best, which combination best, and which place is best, and then launch a positive randomized phase three. I'm anxious that if you launched it as a monotherapy late in this disease, you would end up being impractical, difficult, toxic, and negative.
Yeah, so it sounds like your answer, maybe Tanya, yours too, is maybe not in that time frame because we still have a lot to learn about drug mechanism and partners and microenvironment, et cetera, and how to deliver the therapy to this, you know, more frail population that doesn't lead to CRS and all this stuff, that maybe that time frame is too aggressive, not because of the mechanism of drug, but just maybe the drugs themselves and the development isn't quite on pace to launch a phase three sooner. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think both you and Tom have really hit upon the key points there nicely.
Tanya, my last question, it's a big question, but maybe just bullet point it for me. But you did mention in passing the word CAR-T. I heard it once or twice. And it's obviously close to your heart. And I know you've done some work with CAR-T. Where are we with CAR-T and prostate cancer right now? And how is it related to this work?
Well, so we're still in early phase development for CAR-T and prostate. We've seen proof of principle with exceptional responses, which is, you know, in my view, what we really want from immunotherapy. We want a durable remission where perhaps we could even pull off our...
What were you targeting?
Well, so I've worked with our own City of Hope PSCA targeted CAR-T, but also a couple industry CAR-Ts, including a PSMA targeted one from Poseida. And Susan Slovin showed in the exceptional responder in the poster a couple years ago from the PSMA targeted one. So to me, the advantage of CAR-T is that potential, since it's a living ongoing treatment that doesn't have to continually be administered, that could get to a durable remission in the right combinations. And these fields are learning from each other, right? What we see in the bispecific is informing us about CAR-T and vice versa. And so I think these will work hand in hand to advance the other's development.
No randomized trials with CAR-T yet?
No, but I think it's a different bar perhaps for something like CAR-T cell, because, you know, people often asked me when I was designing my phase one trial, like, how do you want to define response? And for me, it's nothing short of like a durable, complete response. And you know it when you see it. And that's a challenge for a phase three, especially right, in this late line patient right, population.
Tanya, this is fabulous. Really, really interesting. Congrats on the paper and the work. And I think it's definitely an exciting new area area of prostate cancer
immunotherapy. And also our Euroamigos cup holder.
Yeah, well, we should have introduced you as such. Oh.
The Los Angeles team, yes. Outperforming the rest of mainland United States of America.
Although it's not here in Los Angeles, is it? So
it has to be there.
Brian. It's in my closet here. I do need to arrange to ship it out to everybody. Brian, it's been on my list.
It needs to be doing a tour like that Olympic flame. That's what
there's tremendous demand for a cup tour.
Okay, all right, I'm on.
I tell you what, a cup tour is not the worst idea I've heard.
No, it's not actually. Let's talk about
it. It's a brilliant idea. Right, I'll see you soon,
Tanya. Thank you. Appreciate it.
There's going to be a cup tour.
Thanks so much, both of you.
All right, take care.
Bye.